I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man.
Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Taylor. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. We are continuing. We're doing a mini-series here on interviews with state house candidates, particularly challengers, Democratic challengers. And yours is probably one of the most competitive races that we have yet to interview. You ran in 2018, isn't that correct?
That's correct. And we missed by about 1,000 votes. So this time we have been certainly more aggressive with phone banking because of COVID. And we just started to go on door, and we had been doing lit drops. So we're really poised, I think, to flip this seat.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And have you found that you're having good conversations on the phone? Is that working for you guys?
We are having good conversations on the phone. We have a lot of people who are engaged and who are interested. Right now, I'm on the undecided calls. So those calls tend to be a little harder and a little longer. But someone might say to me, tell me three reasons why I should vote for you. So then I have to lay out that. Or someone may have very specific questions that they ask me. And then I have to talk about those particular things. But usually when I talk to a voter, I at least get them to look at my website or to ask questions. And if it's a voter that is more predisposed to vote in this election, then I usually get their vote. So it's been an interesting cycle with COVID and everything else going on.
Yeah, something from just looking at your website, I can see that it's a really volunteer, grassroots-driven campaign. And that's always really exciting. And not a lot of candidates can really pull that off successfully. Do you have any tips for other candidates on how you've been able to execute it?
Well, there are a lot of women engaged since 2016. And I think that a lot of the women relate to me because I'm around their age. And, you know, I have common experiences with them. This particular district has a lot of college educated white women. And so a lot of those women have been willing to do a lot for me over the past, you know, literally 4 years. Some of my volunteers have been with me. And then we have other grassroots groups in the area who are willing to pitch in and help a lot of the different candidates. So yesterday we had a large canvas with a group called the Order of the Phoenix, and they're mostly city. And they came out, and we had 25 people, and wow. Representative Malcolm Kenyatta was there to kick us off, and Congressman Connor Lamb was there, as well as Senator Pam Iovino. So we had a really robust group that went out, and you know, we're actually knocking doors and talking to people. And that was a group that we want to turn out. You know, that we have concerns that they might not come to vote, but we have new vote by mail in Pennsylvania. So in the primary, we were registering people at about 2-1 or to vote by mail of Democrats over Republicans. And right now we're finding we've had the first weekend of the satellite offices open and people receive ballots. They've had them for about a week and a half. Some people had them for 2 weeks. And we had, based on our positive IDs and our partisanship scores, we were quite a bit up on our opponent, and looks like we're up at least 2-1 over her in terms of people voting early who are voting for me.
Well, that's very exciting. And I think that that's probably true for a lot of candidates throughout the state. I've been eyeing the, I think it's called the Election Data Center, and it has information on by county on the returned ballots, and the Democrats up and down the ballot are just sweeping requests and turning it back in at a higher rate. So I think that's good news for every candidate.
Right. And we last weekend, not this past weekend, the weekend before, the state had 16,000 votes turned in, and Allegheny County had 11,000 of those. So Allegheny County did a good job in the primary, and they're doing a good job now. And we just started these satellite sites yesterday Saturday that were quite successful. That's where I voted. I took my ballot there. It was already made out. It was in my security or secrecy envelope, you know, handed it to a county employee who put it into the ballot box for me. So all those things are really, it's very secure. There was a lock on the box. You know, it was clear where you had to go. That morning, I'm told that there was a mile long line of people to vote.
Wow.
At that particular site. So it's really, people are very enthusiastic about voting this year.
Yeah, certainly. And we're happy about it. I want to I want to dig into your platform here, and something that I noticed immediately when I was looking through your website and different things that you've written, and something that I think is really interesting is that you come to this race as an educator and also a former school board director. And so you've seen the education system work from a couple of different perspectives. And I'm curious, given these perspectives that you have, what are we doing well as a state and how can we improve in your opinion?
Well, we have a lot of school districts in the state of Pennsylvania. We do not have a countywide system. And so being said, I have four within the boundaries of this district, and those school districts are doing very well. They're well funded. The attendance is high. The graduation rate is quite high. We have about a 97% high school graduation rate within this district. And many students go on either to technical or career schools or onto four-year colleges. So within this district, we're doing quite well. In the state of Pennsylvania, I think that we just found out recently that we're the most unequally funded education in the entire nation. So in that particular instance, we are not doing well. And that leads one to believe that based on your zip code, it will determine your outcome. You know, so the kids in my particular legislative district are probably have a pretty good outcome in their life because they've been given a lot of opportunities educationally and they'll have opportunities later in life. But kids in zip codes that are not doing as well, where there's a lot of poverty, you have a lot of things that are not playing into the system fairly, they're not going to have the same opportunities later in life. And one of the things that I think we could do better, we base we use our property tax to pay for a lot of our school funding. The state used to fund it about 50% of the burden that the local school districts had. We're now down to 30% of that funding. So they have been, the funding from the state has been going down over the past 10 or so years. And so what we need to do is to fund more at the state level without taxing people so that that gives taxpayers some relief on their property taxes. And so I would suggest that we could use things like closing the Delaware loophole, you know, so that corporations who don't pay any corporate tax in the state of Pennsylvania would have to pay corporate tax. We could use that money to help fund education, that we could use, we could have cyber and charter schools be more accountable. When I was a school board member, we had to account for every single purchase we made, and that was a line item in our budget. So paper was in their transportation, teachers' salaries, all those kinds of things. Even though charters and cybers are using public money, we don't actually have that information from them. So we don't know what their line items are. We don't know where they're spending public money. So I think that's very important. And then another thing we could do is stop subsidizing horse racing in the state of Pennsylvania. We subsidize horse racing quite heavily, actually, for the past 10 years. And I like horses. I rode horses when I was a kid. But I think that children's education is more important. And it turns out that we're subsidizing several people who are millionaires who live out of state. They're not even Pennsylvanians, who are the owners of these horse racing stables. And so we have this year a very large deficit in education because of COVID. And we have many children opting to go to cyber schools as opposed to staying within the system. So we're going to see a very large loss in educational funding this year. So in order to make that up, it would be wise to use some of those funds to then supplement what the state sends. But it wouldn't be a per se tax on the backs of taxpayers. It would be coming from other sources.
So to sort of encapsulate what you're saying is, you see some places where, you know, there's fat in the budget, whether it's the Delaware loophole, which is 74% of corporations that do business in Pennsylvania don't pay any taxes on that because they're able to incorporate in Delaware and get away with our corporate income taxes. And then also the horse racing. If we cut that, then we can basically reduce property taxes and make up for the hole in the school budgets by that other thing, by the cuts that we've made in other places. We can fund schools more fairly and more equally.
Right.
So that we're not relying on property taxes and we're not giving these crazy giveaways to big corporations.
Right. And I don't think that those particular take backs, you know, we're asking people to pay the, you know, the taxes as corporations, or, you know, looking at horse racing in a slightly different light than we are right now is going to hurt that many people in terms of, you know, I don't think we'll see job loss. I don't believe, for instance, that Target will leave the state of Pennsylvania if we ask them to pay corporate taxes in the state of Pennsylvania. So, you know, I'm not looking at grabbing, you know, mom and pop businesses, small businesses. I'm looking at the big guys who are not paying their fair share.
Because mom and pops are penalized in this current system because they can't incorporate in Delaware.
Right. And we have a high corporate tax generally. It's 20%, which is pretty high when you look at other states. Maybe that corporate tax wouldn't have to be so high if everybody paid their fair share.
Yeah. Something that you had mentioned briefly in the beginning that I want to circle back to. We do have a lot of school districts in Pennsylvania. And some people like John Geeting, who's a reporter out of Philadelphia, have cited the sheer number of school districts as a something that adds a lot of cost to it because you can't do as many things at scale. Do you think that consolidating school districts is something that the state legislature should look into, or is that just a hot potato and don't want to touch it?
Well, when I was a kid, there were a lot of mergers, and some of them were hostile mergers, and some of them were very nice. You know, everybody got along really well. And my mom taught at a school district that looked to be that would be a hostile merger. In the end, it worked out okay. You know, it was two rival school districts that merged. My school district that I went to as a kid was a conglomeration of about four or five different communities, and that worked out very well. There is this sort of territorial tribalism to the local school districts. You know, we want our mascot, we want these different things. One of my fears with COVID is that we're going to see some of these very, very tiny school districts that have been struggling anyway, really be unable to bear the burden of what has happened during COVID. So I think we may come to that decision earlier rather than later. We had a very, very successful merger in Beaver County here in Western Pennsylvania, where it was very, it seems to have worked very well down the river a bit from me. And that was a really excellent model for how things could go in the state if we need to merge. Some of our school districts are quite large. One of the school districts within the 44th is Moon Area School District. It's a very, very large district. To merge with other districts might be very burdensome to that district. So I think it probably is more of a case-by-case situation. And I think that having everybody buy into it, like the one in Beaver County that worked very well, will make it easier if that's the way people decide we should go. I think that it's a really touchy subject here in Western Pennsylvania. But we can look to that new school district in Beaver and say, look, they did a very good job and it worked out well for both districts. You know, things like AP courses can be enhanced. You know, you can have some schools are losing their libraries because of the lack of funding. You know, those kind of things. Yeah, those kind of things are, you know, you don't even have to talk about if you have a bigger system. Do I think we'll ever go to a county system? I'm not sure. You know, I think that's a tricky subject for Western Pennsylvania. I think it has been very, the rivalries among football teams and all, you know, that's very embedded in the system. But I do think we can look at the old mergers and say, look, you know, that people were able to get along and work together, and it worked well for those school districts. So it may be something that we were able to work towards in the long run. I'm not suggesting that we do it right away. I'm just thinking that this year might be a deal breaker for some small school districts that they won't be able to find their districts. Yeah, we're looking, I can't remember what the deficit, the overall deficit, I think is $4 billion, and I think possibly a billion in education. And so when you look at that much of a deficit, sadly, you know, some districts are going to still do well because they have higher valued property to tax, whereas some school districts are going to suffer from that. So I think it is a hot potato topic, but I do think that looking at it and thinking about it isn't damaging. I think, you know, just always knowing that it's a possibility. I mean, I was younger, my sisters were quite a bit older than me, and they participated in a merger that went very well, you know, and when they were kids, and my mom taught in a school district that had a merger that went well.
Yeah.
But some people are skeptical about it.
Yeah, I think often in Pennsylvania, we care a lot about like localities and municipalities have a great deal of right. meaning.
Right. We have this COG system in Allegheny County that it really works well for municipalities where they share some resources, the cost. So instead of buying, you know, this little amount of salt or gravel, that they work together to do that. And that works really well for
municipalities. We have a COG in central PA too that does a lot of great stuff. Yeah. I want to go to cyber schools. And if you could just explain to the layman how those are funded, and why, like, them not necessarily being accountable for all of their itemized costs affects taxpayers.
Sure. So when a child or family decides that their child would be better served by a cyber school, whatever amount of money that is taken to educate that child in the school system they're in, the school district they're in, then all that money goes to the cyber school. And when that money leaves the public school, the school district, it goes to the cyber school. And what is tricky about that particular thing is that the school districts have a brick and mortar building to maintain. They have teachers, retirement funds. They have transportation. They have gyms. They have libraries. They have cafeterias, none of which the cybers have. Now, they have teachers, but those cyber teachers may teach a great many students, and they are not required to be certified teachers. So their salaries are not on par with the union teachers that we have in our public schools. So what happens is sometimes kids go to the cyber school and they don't get connected right away to internet. So there is a lag. They perhaps don't get their computer. And I've seen this myself. I work as an early interventionist with very young children with the disabilities and delays from birth to three, and I'm in homes, and there are often older siblings who are supposed to be in a cyber school, and it takes sometimes a long time to connect them because of where they live or to get the computer. And so there is some lag sometimes in that connectivity. So, and then often when a child goes to cyber school, for whatever reason, I shouldn't say often, sometimes when a child goes to cyber school, the family and or the child, and you know, they all come to a decision that it's not really the right fit for the child. So the child wants to return to the public school. The family would like the child to return. It is on the school district to get that money back if the child does not complete the school year. So they are getting a large amount of money for things like that the school district supplies, like busing and all that stuff, that all goes to them. Then if they change their mind and come back to the home district, that money does not just automatically come back. The home district must go after that money, is the expression people use. As a special educator, what often happens with charters and cybers is they will say that they will take any child. But they might say to a family, your child might be better served, say a child that might have a more involved disability, your child might be better served in the public school because they have a PT, an OT, a speech therapist, all these different things. When a child has an IEP in special education, there is a great deal more money allocated to educate that child. So that child is educated fairly according to the federal law. And so when that child would go to a cyber school or a charter school, all that big chunk of money goes. Cybers and charters often say, we probably can't do justice to your child's education because we don't have, say, a PT or an OT, whatever, all the other special things. Usually a charter will take a child with a speech delay, but, and then what happens is they still get this big chunk of money. It's not apportioned appropriately in terms of, you know, the disability. And so you're losing even more money. And I'm talking in the neighborhood of like $30,000, $40,000 from a school district per child for a child with an IEP. So those things are really damaging to the home districts. And sometimes the school board in the home district has to approve a charter, can be appealed to the state, to the board that is mostly empty at the state level to make those decisions. But some school districts are completely surrounded by charters, even though they have never approved one inside their borders. And so they are losing children to those cybers as well, even though they have never given permission to a cyber or charter to operate within their school district boundaries. So
that's a lot there. And I mean, I've just heard some horror stories, particularly in New Jersey, about these fly-by-night for-profit charter schools that, you know, take the money and run, basically.
Yeah. And there are some under investigation by our state treasurer, Treasurer Torsella, right now in the state of Pennsylvania, that are nearby. So I'm interested to see how that comes out.
It's unsettling, and I'm glad that the office is investigating that. I want to move to healthcare.
Sure.
Healthcare is extremely complicated, made complicated by the system that we do to fund it and all of that stuff. And it's just kind of this nested problem. And I'm curious what you think we need to do to make this a more solvent system, a better system for people's health in the state of Pennsylvania.
So I do, working with young children with delays and disabilities and being in homes, often the only person in the home prior to the Affordable Care Act was the child I was working with. You know, the rest of the family was completely uninsured because they didn't, you know, they might be a person who, you know, a father might be a part-time cop, the mom might clean offices, maybe one of the other four children was on CHIP. So I often saw the consequences of that. You know, children weren't taken for their immunizations or they weren't taken for their well care. And certainly when they got sick, it was a big burden to the family. So that has helped a great deal. I see that the governor has been working on an announcement of a healthcare plan. And, you know, we're reviewing this. And I know that he is saying that there is going to be a council to make recommendations by the end of December, and that there would be regional councils to develop regional transition plans. I was just reading that, so I got it right.
I didn't know that. That's great.
And that was announced, I believe it was October 2nd. So that's exciting news. And I know that he's been working with Massachusetts, which is where the Affordable Care Act was modeled. So we don't want any of our people who receive Medicaid to get kicked off of Medicaid. And we were one of the expanded states. We took the expanded Medicaid. You know, seeing, in looking at healthcare, what's really challenging is that when you don't have good healthcare, then you have later in life, not good health. You know, if you don't have good dental care, good eye care, all those things add up. And it's beyond healthcare. It's the dental and the eye care as well. And I have family members in my own family who married into my family who did not have the advantages that my kids had, who had comprehensive healthcare as kids. And as they grew to adulthood, then did get healthcare and were not really sure like what they were entitled to as far as dental exams and dental, you know, cleaning. Didn't know that they could get glasses every year if they needed to get glasses, didn't know that they should get a checkup every year, that they should get, you know, shots for different things. So I've seen that unfold in my own life, and seeing that makes me think that the health consequences are so dire for people who don't have the access that it's critical that we do something as a state to make sure that everybody has it. I was fortunate to have corporate healthcare through my husband for many years, but now I'm on the Affordable Healthcare plan. And it's a little more complex than I would like it to be. The first year I bought the wrong plan. The second year I think I have the right plan. It's not exactly like comparing apples to apples all the time when you're trying to pick a plan. I think it would be nice to be more simplified. So it would be very easy for people to access and to utilize in the best way for them. And then I actually had my last year's health plan say to me when I was going for a procedure that it wasn't going to be paid for at all. And it was quite expensive. And I said, well, I don't understand. I thought I bought this pretty good plan. And he said, well, you bought healthcare for people who don't use it. So what kind of healthcare is that? That's not.
Yeah. Healthcare. What the heck?
Yeah, I know. So I don't know if like for people who are quite young, who are very healthy. I mean, I didn't have anything really wrong with me. I just needed a test. So those kind of statements really disturb me. So I feel like I need to know that people are going to be covered comprehensively. And, you know, Vice President Biden has talked about being able to maintain your own healthcare if you like, and then improving on the Affordable Healthcare Act. So I think that's a solid idea having been in both things. I have a son-in-law who's a union member and one who's about to become a union member. And union healthcare is generally excellent. You know, they're
they do a really good job of getting that coverage.
Really good job. But we have lots and lots of frontline workers who have no paid sick leave. You know, and that's a problem, especially right now. You know, people who we're asking to put their lives on the line, like grocery store workers and people who are out picking up sanitation. You know, we don't have some of these people are not getting paid health or healthcare leave. Or there was some question is if, you know, if you contacted COVID outside your workspace, would you be covered? You know, so those kind of questions, I think, are really unfortunate in today's climate. And I'm a big supporter of the nurses. And nurses are our frontline workers who need to be supported with proper PPE. You know, we need to have paid sick leave. Even if you think about it in a very selfish way, here's why you should always root for paid sick leave. If I go to Wendy's or I go to, you know, the local, you know, fast food place, if you want to edit out Wendy's.
Or at a bank, you know.
Anyway, right. And those people do not have paid sick leave and they are working ill. That's putting me at risk. You know, so if you want to look at it selfishly, if you want to look at it, you know, from a humanitarian standpoint, which I tend to do, it's just the compassionate human thing to do for people, you know, that everybody should have the right to take off work when they're sick, you know, and to be able to feel, you know, I've had prior to the Affordable Care Act, and it's probably still going on, because I had families who had no money to really pay in when that first started. They would rather pay the fine. And I had families who were told in minimum wage, that's another whole topic in the state of Pennsylvania, minimum wage jobs, if they took any more time off because their child was sick, their child who had been in daycare, childcare, that they would lose their job. You know, so not only do you not have the health care leave, you know, the paid sick leave, but you're being threatened with the loss of your job. You know, so those are just not... that's not the kind of state I want to live in. You know, we're in a commonwealth for the common good of everybody. And I want to see everybody get a fair shake.
So I was listening to somebody. I think I was just reading a comment on Facebook and somebody was talking about how great the economy was before COVID. And it just, it makes me so, so furious that, you know, it's like, if you don't understand by now that part of a healthy economy is a healthy populace that has access to paid sick leave and has good, affordable, quality healthcare, then, I mean, that's an integral part of having a good economy and a healthy workforce.
And I think everything sort of leads back to education because I'm an educator. If you have a well-educated populace that makes good decisions about healthcare and to vote, for instance, all those things lead to a better job that will have healthcare probably attached to it. If not, we need to have a good healthcare system. We cannot continue to take our workforce for granted.
Yeah. I think so many of the problems that we're dealing with right now were just completely brought on by the Corbett administration. I don't know if that's PC.
We know as an educator, I have to say, you know, that's the thing about hearing that we might lose $1 billion this year in education, because we just clawed our way back to that billion that he cut from education 10 years ago. I mean, it took us 10 years to get back to that. And in that 10 years, things have moved on. So now we're still behind the eight ball. Yeah. And if we lose that $1 billion again, we're going to have to try, how are we going to get that back? You know, I mean, these are daunting questions. And
regarding healthcare too. I mean, he cut the adult basic program. He slashed dental benefits for Medicaid recipients Medicare recipients.
Right.
It's just like everything was just a wholesale cut on social programs and
things that help
people.
Yeah, educators are very fond of saying there's this preschool to prison pipeline. If you don't have a good preschool education and you don't graduate from high school, you're much more likely to be incarcerated. And Pennsylvania has one of the largest incarcerated populations in the country. We spend billions on that every year. And we now have this aging population. So it's now you have the health issues and the medical issues that it's like a incarcerated nursing home almost in some cases.
Yeah. I was talking recently with somebody that's running out in Elk County, and a lot of our talk focused on addressing brain drain, because we're just hemorrhaging people in these rural counties.
Sure.
I want to talk with you about your district, the 44th.
Sure.
And if you could just tell me about, like, who is the average voter and what they're looking for, and why you think that you're best suited to represent them.
The average voter in this district is a college-educated white woman about my age, middle age, excuse me, a little older. It is a district that enjoys very good school districts. It is a district that enjoys, a pretty well-educated voting population. Half of the district is, I would say, a little more liberal than the other half is a little more conservative. We have fracking on one side of the river. This is bisected by the Ohio River in Pittsburgh. And we're southwest of the city. And one side of the river is vehemently opposed to fracking. So you have that dichotomy as well. We have one side of the district is Swickley Heights, where we have very affluent families. And the other side of the district in Findlay and North Fayette has families who are still will say when you talk to them that their families are historically coal miners, that, you know, that they, their grandparents were coal, you know, their grandfather was a coal miner, their dad was a coal miner, and they continue in the oil and gas industry. So it's a big diversity in terms of jobs. It's not very diverse in terms of race or ethnicity, but there is a big diversity in terms of what one might expect to be employed in. And I think that, everybody almost is interested in education, even people whose children have gone through the system and are now, you know, their children are grown, are still very interested in how children are going to be educated. And of course, even if you're a senior in Pennsylvania, you're still paying property taxes to support that education. So you care where your money is being spent. So I think my education background has a lot of appeal to people. I've been a resident of Ohio Township, which is part of this district, for 37 years. I raised my kids here, my three daughters. They all graduated from public high school. One still lives in the district. Two others are outside of the district. I was a volunteer in the school and the community. So, excuse me. So there is a lot of connectivity in my own community. I attend church in another municipality in the district. I, you know, belong to the YMCA in another municipality in the district. So my sister lived in Moon School District for 50 years of her life. She's since passed away and her husband is still there. So, and her children attended the school. So I have connectivity through her friends and her participation in the community. So I think that being a part of the community, having lived here, having been a part of this community is a strong sign to people that, you know, I care about the community. And I, started an infant car seat program for the local women's club when I was younger, when people had to have infant car seats when they were discharged from the hospital. I started a nonprofit to get books into children's hands in underserved areas in 2019. And we distributed 3,000 books into underserved areas in the region. A lot of my donors were people within the district because their children had grown or their children had, you know, and they were gently used books. A lot of my donors were libraries within the district who said, here are some books for you to get to kids who don't have any books, you know, and so that people know me as someone who is interested in my community and also outside of my community, because we certainly in this district don't live in a bubble. You know, we commute to work outside of the district. We, people come inside this district to work. I've also served a lot of children as an early interventionist within this district. I've worked for the past 16 years, and a lot of those families live within this district. I've served children in every one of the 13 municipalities within this district. So I know people in every circumstance, whether they're very wealthy or whether they're middle class or whether they're struggling.
Yeah. Three questions that I've been asking every candidate that I've been interviewing, and I'll ask you, is the first one being, what is something that perhaps either in talking with people or researching issue, what's something that you've learned that surprised you?
Property taxes is a huge issue in this district. People, so I was a little surprised by that. Let me think what else I might say that was surprising. I guess it was surprising to me. I know that in my own township, we've had some problems with landslides because a lot of the old roads in this area were built on old trails or, you know, next to a stream or on the top of the ridge. I read an article when I first moved over here that they were just paved over, you know, at, these are old areas in Western Pennsylvania. People have lived here for, you know, a couple hundred years. And so they were, you know, cow paths, and my own road was not paved when we moved here. So it's been paved since. So it was, you know, adjacent up above a stream, and it probably was made access to that stream easy. But what I was surprised at is all over the district, we are having landslides. The roads are collapsing. Roads are closed for a year, 2 years at a time. People just sort of adapt and take the other route to get out of their community. So something that I was shocked at the number of roads, you know, that we're looking at that are affected by that. But I was also dismayed to hear on a show on the local WESA, our NPR station, that that those slides are most often, if it's personal property, they aren't, well, and PennDOT even doesn't even have any budget in there. There's no budget for landslides. So if a road collapses on one side, funding has to be kind of accumulated to be able to correct that problem. So that was something that was sort of surprising.
Definitely surprising. I don't think landslides when I hear Allegheny County.
No, and it's been, I think, increasing because we have, you know, certainly people building in unusual places that they didn't build before. And then, you know, we have a very high increase in rainfall the past few years, you know, which may be certainly attributed to climate change. You know, so it's very dramatic when you see it on the coast with hurricanes, but here, you know, roads collapse.
Yeah, no place is untouched by that. Yeah. The second question that I'm asking everybody is, what have you been streaming on Netflix or HBO during
Okay, so pandemic? I don't have HBO and I don't have Netflix. My kids were telling you we have Stars and I don't have time to watch TV.
Okay.
So I wish I could say, because I think my ads are running on some of those things like Netflix and Hulu and cool stuff. And I haven't seen them on there. If I have a chance to watch something, I might catch the PBS NewsHour or CNN to check out the news, but I have not really had time. I really, really don't have time to watch TV.
That's totally a fair answer. The last question is, how can people get in touch with your campaign if they hear this and they want to help out?
I will say about streaming, we did get, when Hamilton was playing on TV, we did get, that was the last thing, but, you can reach my campaign at michellenoll.com. That's our website. And on there, we have our email and there's an ActBlue link if anybody would like to contribute. And, my email, if anybody wants to email me, is noll4pa44@gmail.com. That's a number 4. And that's number 44, and Noll is spelled K-N-O-L-L. So if anybody's interested, they're certainly welcome to email me, ask me questions, and we're phone banking. We just are upping it to 3 times a week this week. So we are on phones.
Wow.
3 times a week, but we also have this great plan. It's like a bargain plan. You can join the 10 calls a day club. So I have over 30 people who are, if they're interested in making phone calls for me, and they have 20 minutes, they can make 10 calls in 20 minutes. And then they can make 10 calls the next day. Some people like to do, you know, 30 or 40 calls. But we are now in the process of turnout and chasing ballots. So we know that some people have gotten ballots, but they haven't quite voted yet. We expect big numbers to come in today from these satellite places that collected ballots this weekend. So we expect to see a big surge in numbers. And so we will be chasing people who have not turned their ballots in. Some people are deciding to vote in person, even though they got a ballot, because they're a little concerned about election night.
Yeah.
So I voted this weekend at a satellite site. It was very, very comfortable for me to do that. I felt it was secure. But if anybody wants to help us phone bank, we certainly would welcome that. You could send an email to me or contact us through our website. And we are canvassing. We're on door now. If anybody wants to knock doors for us. We are texting. We have several text programs going, and we will be doing a huge GOTV that we would welcome anybody's help with as we get closer to the election. We're going to have a couple practice runs of GOTV the next couple weeks, and then we'll be ready to hit the ground and do a massive move on voters who have not yet voted.
Thank you so much for your time, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Taylor. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I've been everywhere. Oh, I've been everywhere, man.